by any means necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today, a little bit later, we'll be talking about some of the environmental costs of a Trump administration, as well as some of the things that the president can still do, President Obama, before he gets out of there in terms of commuting the sentences of over-sentenced prisoners in the federal system. But before we can move on, many people are asking whether or not Democrats in the Senate will be able to stop the appointment of major finance figure Steve Mnuchin from becoming Secretary of the Treasury. Mnuchin has a pretty bad record of kicking people out of their homes for no reason, which is something many people are hoping could trip him up at the confirmation hearings. And let's recap some of his history for you. Mnuchin was the lead on a group of major investors who bought the troubled mortgage lender IndyMac in 2009. The government had taken the bank over because it had so many faulty mortgages. Mnuchin and his friends not only bought the bank, but got a deal from the government that they would cover any losses over a certain threshold, and the bank was then renamed One West. Then, for the next 6 years, One West went about foreclosing on thousands of people, 36,000 to be exact. So many that One West has been called a foreclosure machine by some advocates for homeowners. One West also pursued the illegal practice of negotiating with homeowners to make them think that they will get a loan modification, while at the same time pursuing foreclosure proceedings and then taking people's homes. For example, Leslie Parks in Minneapolis came home during a blizzard in 2009 to find her locks changed when she thought she was negotiating for a loan modification. And again, this practice, known as dual tracking, is not legal. One West also only controlled 17% of the reverse mortgages that target senior citizens. However, they performed 39% of the foreclosures on reverse mortgages, including a 103-year-old woman who was foreclosed on after her insurance lapsed. And despite all of this, rather than receive any sort of punishment, One West, which Mnuchin and company have now sold, received over $1 billion from the government during his tenure to cover the cost of foreclosing on thousands of people. Good work if you can get it. And now it turns out Kamala Harris, new California senator and Democratic Party superstar, was also looking the other way on Mnuchin and his friends when she was the California Attorney General. Turns out her office found evidence of what it called, quote, widespread misconduct, close quote. And they found literally over 1,000 violations of foreclosure laws by One West during Mnuchin's tenure. And when asked about her office's approach to these kind of cases, she told The Hill, quote, we take a case wherever the facts lead us, end quote. So what direction was that? Well, it was a direction that led to One West facing no action. Yes, that's right. Despite having over 1,000 examples of One West violating the law and illegally removing people from their homes, Kamala Harris chose to do nothing. Now, Harris is one of the Democrats' rising stars, widely believed to be a front runner for a future presidential nomination. Now, you don't think she declined to prosecute because she was hoping to tap Mnuchin for campaign donations later, do you? Nah, couldn't be, right? Well, it is worth noting he did give her $2,000 for her Senate run this past year, which she won. Just saying. Republicans have made it no secret they want to roll back as many regulations as possible. For the party of unabashed capitalism, anything that potentially restricts unfettered profit-making, even if it saved a child's life or removed carcinogens from food, has to be resisted, and resisted at all cost. The interests of the almighty dollar are all that really matter. They have drawn up a list of things, Republicans, that is, that they feel they can repeal right away. And they introduced a bill known as the Midnight Rules Relief Act of 2017, which passed the House Wednesday just before the close of business, 4:48 p.m., in fact. Now, before we get back to exactly why that's important, what were they trying to repeal? Well, nothing quite yet. What this act does is amend the Congressional Review Act so that a large number of regulations can then be bundled together and repealed all at once. So it sets the stage for mass repeal, which you can't currently do. But what are they targeting? Well, it's not fully known, but some of the broad outlines, as shown to us by the Washington Post, are, quote, deter mining companies from polluting drinking water sources, rules designed to curb hazardous methane emissions from fracking sites, and a rule that extends the threshold for overtime pay to workers. David Levine of the American Association for Sustainable Business told The Hill that passing this act and repealing so many things at once was like, quote, taking a chainsaw into surgery. So back to the time thing. Now, House Speaker Paul Ryan really talked up the Midnight Relief Act deal. He gets the thing passed at 4:48. Now, where was he just a short couple hours later? Well, a few hours later at 7 p.m.? Well, he was at a party thrown by lobbyists. Which lobbyist? Well, the BGR Group, major firm here. And who might they represent? Well, how about Chevron, Johnson & Johnson, Xerox, Celgene, among others? So in other words, the exact same people who will heavily benefit from repealing all these regulations. What a coincidence. As you may, or perhaps may not, remember, Donald Trump's central campaign promise was to build a wall on the border with Mexico to keep out immigrants. Let's listen to President-elect Donald Trump now.
As you know, I know how to build. I know how to get it done. We'll have a great wall. We'll call it the Great Wall of Trump. We'll have a great wall, and it can be a good-looking wall, as walls go, but we will have a really terrific wall, and it'll be done for the right price. You know, for you.
Well, that was Donald Trump, a good-looking wall as walls go. Okay. And as you will remember, he also was selling this by saying that none of us would have to pay for the wall. We were not going to pay for the wall, but Mexico was going to pay for the privilege of having a wall erected along their entire border, northern border. However, on Thursday, multiple reports emerged that Trump transition team members and congresspeople were huddling together trying to find a way to use U.S. taxpayer funds, not Mexicans now, to build the wall, which, big embarrassment for Donald Trump when it came out, given how vehemently he had stated that Mexico would indeed pay. Trump's response was, you know, as you might expect, to take to Twitter and excoriate the media for being dishonest. I guess let me just read the tweet. He says, this is Trump, quote, "The dishonest media does not report that any money spent on building the Great Wall for sake of speed will be paid back by Mexico later," end quote. Paid back by Mexico later. Well, as a businessman, Donald Trump has a reputation for not paying his contractors. Looks like as a politician, he's gaining a reputation for the bait and switch. You remember when senators like Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio were really upset about the Benghazi attacks? They went to town on Hillary Clinton and the Obama administration for not providing the proper security for the embassy, leading to the death of Ambassador Chris Stevens. Cruz once said about this, "Our brave men and women who continue to put their lives on the line every day in similar dangerous situations deserve to know we are doing everything possible not only to protect them in the event of a terrorist attack, but also to deter these attacks from happening again. Better late than never," end quote. Rubio also addressed the same issue, telling Breitbart, quote, "It's my hope that this report serves as a reminder of the importance of allocating the appropriate resources to keep all Americans safe both at home and abroad around the world. Congress and the executive branch need to work together to do everything possible to make sure something like this does not happen again," end quote. That all sounds pretty reasonable, right? Make sure you keep the politics out of funding security at the various embassies around the world. Well, in case you needed any more evidence at all that Rubio and Cruz are complete and total opportunist, careerist type of people, you now have the definitive proof, as Rubio and Cruz were two of three co-introducers of a bill that could strip all funding for embassy security from the budget. The bill, which requires the U.S. move its embassy to Jerusalem, would mandate that if the president failed to accomplish this task, then there would be no money for embassy security overall. So yes, that's right. Two of the most prominent Republicans who spent an entire few years saying how important it was nothing ever be done to endanger U.S. embassy personnel literally just introduced a bill that actually uses the safety and lives of embassy personnel as a bargaining chip in a political battle. Way to keep your promises, guys. And those were today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary, as always, here on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By Any Means Necessary.
And we are joined in studio to continue our conversation by Bob Schlee-Huber, an analyst here at Sputnik News. Bob, thank you for joining the show.
As always, it's always a pleasure to be here.
No, perfect. Kamala Harris, let's start there. Democrat rising star, could be a candidate for president in 4 years. You know, any surprise here that this took place, and how does this affect, do you think, her progressive reputation?
I kind of giggled to myself there when you said, well, she could be a candidate. I think after Donald Trump, anybody and everybody could be a candidate for president 4 years from now. But no, this shouldn't be surprising whatsoever. Kamala Harris is a little bit more to the left of a lot of or some of the mainstream establishment Democrats. But even people on the far left take money from developers and take money from big special corporate interests and lobbyists. We've talked on this show, and you've had guests on your show talking about the relationship between payday lenders and the Democratic Party. If payday lending might be the most abusive form of lending in this entire country that keeps people in cycles of poverty the rest of their life once they take one of those loans. And yeah, we see Debbie Wasserman Schultz putting up legislation in Florida to protect those payday lenders. We see President Obama taking over $100,000 from Rod Acock, the largest payday lender in all of the country, for his inaugural parties and celebrations and whatnot. So are we surprised? No, you absolutely shouldn't be surprised. And even more worrying some is even Keith Ellison, who's now the leader and future hope for the Progressive Party within the Democrats, supported billionaire developer Stephen Biddle against a progressive Dwight Bullard in the state Florida Democratic Party race. And now Biddle is tied to Ellison, and Biddle owns over $1 billion of property.
So Biddle won that race.
Biddle won that race.
That's an interesting question, too, because Dwight Bullard had made he was a state representative in Florida, a lot of news because he had gone on the trip to Palestine, I believe, with the Dream Defenders. They came back. One of like Hillary Clinton's top fundraisers tried to coup him in the primary. He crushes the guy. He doesn't back off at all from his positions on Palestine. Keith Ellison, on the other hand, though, has done everything possible to sort of genuflect now towards the pro-Israel forces, and seems willing to sacrifice even previous balanced positions, or quote-unquote balanced positions, at least better than the status quo, that have come around. Really quite worrisome.
And Biddle, on top of it, is very vocal about his support for Israel and conservative Jewish values within the country, even though he is a Democrat. And so, it is completely worrisome. And so now Ellison's tainted by this relationship, and I think the whole Democratic Party is. So should we be surprised with Kamala Harris being in bed with a big developer and the company that she was, One West? No, I don't think so.
Well, Bob, I have to ask you this. How did it go at BGR Group after the midnight repeal relief, whatever the hell, bill passed? Was it a raucous party?
The big party. You know, it's weird because in my younger days, I've actually worked on the Capitol grounds working as a caterer doing bartending. I think if the average American had any clue of these after work happy hours, hors d'oeuvres, light fare and fare food for congressional staff and congressional members, they would be blown away. I mean, It's like these people are working to serve the people of America, but every night they take their suits and themselves down to these fancy parties and can drink on the house. And then I think it kind of speaks to a deeper problem in America, that the people that represent us are not the same people that we think they are. We think they're just middle-class Americans. We think they're everyday people. You know, I mean, the initial idea that our farmers or our local small business owner would then serve us because they're from the people. Well, these politicians aren't from the people, and they live very luxurious lives here in Washington, D.C., most of them at least, and are at fancier parties. The other story that it reminded me, too, is we were at the Trump Tower just down the street from our studios here in Washington, D.C., and we were covering an anti-Trump protest, and there was two people there that were Trump supporters, and they were decked out in Trump gear. They had all the signs for Trump. They were chanting two of them against the 150 or so people that were there with all their force. They were talking to every media outlet supporting Trump. They were boasting and trying to rebuke everything that was said negatively against Trump. And the last question that one of the interviewers asked him, they go, so this is great. So are you guys planning on staying at Trump Tower now? And they go, oh, no. We couldn't afford to stay here. I mean, it's just mind-blowing that people would give so much support to people that are so much more wealthy than them, and they think they're going to properly represent them, even though they're not welcome to the same parties that they're welcome to.
No, I think that's a very good point to make there in terms of Trump's own supporters. So the wall, the Great Wall, going to be pretty good looking as walls go.
What does he mean by that? I don't. I just want to know what his head is like. Oh yeah, that would look like. I mean, is it just his name on the side of it? And that's what makes it a Great Wall.
Do they do artwork? And is it which
windows?
Side of
so
the
you can
wall
see
is
through
the
it,
nice
kind
side?
Of?
Both sides. Because if Mexico is later going to pay for it, you have to produce some sort of art. This is the country with some of the greatest murals of any country on earth. So, I mean, if you want them to pay for it, you got to go full on like Diego Rivera. If they put honestly, if there was a giant pro-communist Diego Rivera mural on the wall, I don't think I would be for the wall, but, you know, at least I could say that there was some positivity.
I mean, does, like, if does Mexico troll them and say, hey, we'll pay for it, and then you get some concrete that, like, design by design falls apart in 10 years, or, like, does something, or, like you said, have a painting on it just to troll Trump? I mean, what do you do if you're Mexico?
They will never pay for the wall.
I'm just fascinated with what Trump thinks he's going to be able to do. And maybe we're all fools for thinking that he doesn't have all this unilateral power. I guess if George W. Bush could unilaterally take the United States to a war and kill millions of people, then maybe the president of America can unilaterally
build a wall
and then somehow charge Mexico for it, or simply say that anything you want to import into the United States, well, we're going to impose this tariff on your country until you pay for that wall. And we're going to crush all of your businesses that rely on U.S. consumerism. And the same thing with nuclear weapons. I mean, yesterday on the show, you were talking about how it's silly to think that Trump's just going to make these different countries give up their nuclear weapons. But maybe he can impose some tariffs, or maybe there is some way that he can. So I don't know. I've questioned and doubted Trump so many times. I'm just going to wait and see. And maybe somehow he gets Mexico to pay for the wall at this point, because who knows anymore?
I mean, if we're being truly serious, the real place would be in a NAFTA renegotiation, and that you trade paying for the wall for some sort of long-term economic benefit for Mexicans that will, you know, allow Peña Nieto or whoever the president is at the time. But that's the other wild card here, is that the government in Mexico, the next government, who knows, could be, you know, a left-wing government for that matter, and they weren't going to be interested in that at all. Tel Aviv to Jerusalem embassy move. I mean, I don't even know what to say. Like, Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, like, and the whole Republicans, like, staked their life on Benghazi. And then, like, immediately you turn around and you introduce a bill that's like, yeah, we'll kill every other embassy person if you don't move it to Jerusalem. I mean, get out of here.
Yeah, and the Congress is going to be behind that. I mean, they had the House Resolution 11 that came out the other day that was basically denouncing the UN Resolution 2334, which criticized Israel for their settlements, the illegal settlements recognized by international law, as well as the Supreme Court of Israel, that their belligerent occupations, that they should no longer be allowed. The House put forward a bill that slammed it and denounced the bill as a way to avoid being able to reach a two-state solution. It passed 342-80. The only Republic, I love it. The Texas governor, or Texas Congressman Gohmert, was upset by the two-state solution language in there. Not necessarily the UN resolution. Obviously, he was upset by both, but it was always kind of funny when you find bipartisan support was like on the lower language of like, wait, we should never actually have peace. That he was upset.
Whoa.
But what does this lead to? I don't know how you don't end up at a third intifada or some type of mass uprising from Palestinian people if they try to move the capital to Jerusalem, in that region of the world already being so volatile. Does the United States need to, like, engulf and anger more people? Like, is that really the solution? I think we already have war fatigue. I think we already see in our country that we're not necessarily running to rush in and create more chaos within the Middle East. And a move like this would do nothing but create more chaos. And so then again, do we see the Trump administration and his hawkish approach ultimately lead to his downfall with a mass mobilization of anti-war activists or peace builders here in this country?
True. Well, I certainly hope for that. And I also hope that they might be not hoping for more chaos as a Trojan horse to try to get in there and annex the entire West Bank, because they have no quote unquote partner for peace. But be that as it may, people will remain vigilant. We will remain vigilant on this show. We're taking a break. We will be back on By Any Means Necessary here on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking a little bit about continued efforts to seek clemency for those who have really been unbelievably over-sentenced over the years in the era of mass incarceration. And we are very happy to be talking today with the Reverend Dr. Madeline McClinney Sadler, the president and founder of the Exodus Foundation, and Sebastian Goodson, who's a special assistant to Reverend Madeline, or Dr. Madeline, I should say. And as you all remember, they've been on the show several times before. Thank you so much, both you guys, for coming back.
Glad to be back.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Madeline, I'll start with you here. I'm curious, you are launching a hunger strike now as well in demand of clemency, so please feel free to talk about that. I wonder, in terms of the travels you do and the work you do, what response do you get from people who have been victimized by violence and crime? I always think that's an interesting piece, and I know the Alliance for, what do they call themselves, something public safety, did an interesting study a few months ago where they found the vast majority of people who'd been victims and had their families victimized wanted to see not law and order policies, the opposite of that. So I wonder if you see similar things in your own work.
Oh, that's great. I need to know about that. So, you know, I do think I see some measured responses from people who are victims of traumatic crime. In other words, they are not universally inclined to say, throw away the key, lock them up and throw away the key. But I do meet enough people to take to know that we need to also make clear in our advocacy that we are not dismissive of the pain and injury that comes when someone steals from us, when someone kills or murders someone that we love. In fact, I did my first Facebook Live. I'm going to be doing it every night, every day, until the 20th. And that was the first thing I addressed, victims of crime. Because I wanted to put it out there to the family, the human family, that we want to see fewer victims of crime. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So we generally talk about reducing the numbers of people who go back to prison. I have to have that discussion because that's how our success is measured, right? Our success is measured by the government and by grant makers. You know, are the people you serve going back to prison? Mm. But the question that really needs to be answered, and the goal that we're seeking, is no more victims of crime. Mm. How can we stop hurting each other? And that's what we should be measuring. Right. And that happens when communities are stronger, when families are stronger, when there are real safety nets, mm-hmm. and when our goal is not to destroy each other when we make mistakes and harm each other.
Right. Well, you know, Sebastian, I think it's a good question because it speaks to, I think, the mentality of a lot of guys. And you've been incarcerated yourself. I mean, I've had the opportunity to meet people around the country. You know, I've sat in rooms of hundreds of people who are formerly incarcerated talking about how they can make a difference in their community. And that's kind of another piece of this, too, right, is that it's not just like, you know, you're just opening the doors or whatever, but it's part of a broader process of rebuilding community, which I think we often lose because so many people, men especially, were taken away. And that process of rebuilding is something that so many incarcerated people are looking to be a part of. And that is a big piece of this effort as well. So I was hoping you could speak a little bit to that as a formerly incarcerated person who is making a difference in his community, I should say.
Thank you. That is one of the biggest reasons and problems that we have out here. You know, most of the guys come out and they already have took the education system out of the part. You know, it's all about factory working, you know, what you're going to work for, you know, again, back to their Willie Lynch plantation type style. But what we don't understand is if we start taking up all these trades as carpenter, painting, and all this, and come back and learn how to garden, you know what I'm saying? This is something that we need. We need trainers. We need counselors. I can never repeat this over again. We need case managers. As Doc put in her plan, you know, for the press concert. And as I said, we do not know how to communicate well. You know what I'm saying? So when we come out here, we already got a stigma on it, as Doc said. But at the same time, we are afraid to move forward. We are afraid to take these challenges on building the community. So if you got somebody, if you got five guys that's been released and they've been doing life sentence, you might have one guy to come out here and say, go to church and say, I want to help. I want to start this camp. I want to help build a community back up. I want to, you know, take these young guys and let's go around and clean up these yards right here and stop the trash in the community with the elders. No, we are afraid because, if I don't get a job, they're going to lock me back up. I'm afraid that master going to get mad at me if I do this. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But it's a shame. And it brings you to tears sometimes to know that your mind can be locked like that, unlocked and locked at somebody else's key. Then you don't have your own thoughts. You know what I'm saying? And it's bad because we don't want to excel outside. We don't want to expand our mindset. We don't want to expand our heart. So we be confused, and some of us don't know how to love. We don't know how to take away our pride, our ego, and say, "Doc, teach me. Teach me how to love. Teach me how to learn. Teach me how to read." We don't want that. We want to teach me how to sell drugs. Show me how to use this gun. Show me how to go out there and kill my own. And then when the police come, you're going to throw your guns down. What's that? That's afraid. That's frightened. That's the Will and Lynch program. You light-skinned, I'm brown-skinned. I hate you. She light-skinned, I'm dark-skinned. I hate you. I'm going to make that mentality be a realized reality. So guess what? We're going to continue to be down here, struggling with one another, hurting one another, not loving, and not building our community.
No, I think that's a fantastic observation. I mean, I've always felt that, I don't want to be the tinfoil hat guy, but, you look at what the war on drugs and all of the effect it had on the community and pitting so many of our own people that's against right. each other. And even till today in the criminal justice reform world, the same people try to do the same thing, pitting people against each other. It's either victims versus perpetrators, young versus old. It's all around dividing a community. And I don't know, Dr. Madeline, it seems to me like almost – what we are dealing with is the trying to mitigate the effects of like a deliberate attempt to hold black people back in this country. I mean, is that too bold to say?
Yes, that is an element. That is a strong element in policy making in the history of this country. I mean, that's been demonstrated. Nixon colleagues have come out and said he purposefully wanted to target minority communities with the war on drugs. So we know that. But then there's this trauma
right.
that we have as people of color that has not been addressed, that we pass down from generation to generation if people in our families do not make concerted efforts to say, okay, it stops with my line. Mm-hmm. I am not going to repeat the abuse that my slave master put upon me and pass it on to my children and beat them and whip with them with telephone cords and tree branches and all the kind of stuff that now we kind of brag about. Mm. Oh, my mama beat me this way.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, my master beat me this way. That comes from somewhere.
Mm.
So we've got to address both the structural barriers and the trauma that has not been treated.
Mm.
And so we got some sicknesses to deal with. And at the same time, we got to struggle. And so we're overwhelmed in many instances.
Right.
But what we need, what I want your listeners to do is wake, and I'm going to keep it polite. But, if I was just driving down the car down the street with Sebastian, I might say, wake the hell up. Right. But I wouldn't say that on your radio show. Right. But so people need to wake up because this is how we go backwards.
Mm. Mm.
And it can't be just about me and mine.
Right.
It can't be just about, the people in the other zip code.
Right.
Right. Because everything affects everybody.
Mm.
And so we need your listeners to call 202-456-1111, the number at the White House, and say, why hasn't President Obama spoken about the Exodus Coalition plan?
Mm.
What we're doing with this sacred fast is to garner support for clemency, to demonstrate that we are our brother's keeper.
Right.
And for me, if it comes to the point where I have to perish, so be it. I don't have a martyr complex. I have a 13-year-old. I can think of a lot more work I'd like to do. But when does this stuff stop? When do we understand that caged lives matter? They matter. Those are human beings that we treat as lepers.
I mean, massive dehumanization. I think that something that Sebastian said really spoke to me is the issue of love, compassion, empathy, where we've just sort of set up this whole mentality where it's like, if you are in prison, you're a terrible person. And it's like, not only do the people on the outside internalize it, I think people on the inside internalize it. Like, we've just created this. I think leper is a great word. Like, because what did they do? Send them off to some island in some colony as far away as you could get them and just forget that they ever existed.
And to speak on that, I don't understand how you can hate something that you created.
Mm.
Something that came from you. What difference is you, because you didn't get caught?
Mm-hmm.
Or you got enough money to pay your way out of it?
That's
you know what
right.
I'm saying?
No, I hear you.
But guess what? You built the cage. Because you didn't build it on planet nine, when yours come in, it's a fact. But now, before you even vote on this, listen here. She just told you to call the number. But we don't just want you to call Barack Obama. We want you to call the transition team. We want you to call Amarosa. We want you to call Donald Trump. We want you to call everybody. This ain't just about Obama. It's about, but what I need you to understand, listeners all across the world, this is your family member. Mm. This is your brother, your sister, your daughter, your nephew, your niece, your nephew, grandma, grandma. They locked all of us up.
Right.
It's no different. But if you want them, Dr. Madeline got a coalition plan on his desk for whoever can make the decision. Make the decision. I guarantee you, if you don't, I would go into detail what will happen in the next couple of years, but I'm not.
No, I hear you. I hear you. And then exodusfoundation.org.org, exodusfoundation.org.org. Just remember that, and you will have the ability to find all this information, and you can just keep listening to this show. Just keep replaying the part with the number, and then you'll be totally fine. But that's another way to connect the folks at Exodus. Please, Dr. Madeline, go ahead.
So what Sebastian is talking about is the danger that not taking action puts our nation in. Mm. the public safety damage done when people lose faith in their criminal justice system, which is already happening. And so we can't afford not to look at the issue of clemency.
Right.
And so we need your listeners with contacts to journalists around the world to put pressure by writing about this, going to our website, www.exodusfoundation.org, where you can see a summary of the plan. Mm. And I'm happy to send you a copy of the plan if you write to me at exodus@exodusfoundation.org. Let me tell you just briefly what the plan is. It's a plan for increasing the number of federal prisoners eligible for clemency before President Obama leaves office. It offers a new set of criteria for clemency and a method for identifying those who meet those criteria on a case-by-case basis over a short period of time. So essentially, Loretta Lynch has said, oh, there's not going to be any mass clemency, even though that's what Cut 50 asked for and other groups have asked for, an all nonviolent, all over charge. She says, because we have to look at them case by case. Well, our Exodus plan does that. So what the way it does that in the nick of time, it identifies people eligible for clemency by categories. So the president says everyone, what we need him to say is everyone that fits into these categories identified by the Exodus Coalition Plan, I hereby commute the remaining portion of their sentences. Then, with University of North Carolina Charlotte scholars and a coalition of people trained for this work, we go into the prisons over a five-year period and identify who met those categories after the fact. As it stands, people who are granted clemency now are not going to get out for 2 or 3 years sometimes anyway. So this is not some new thing that you're granted clemency and you get out right away. No, most people don't get out immediately.
Right.
Some in 6 months, some in 18 months, some in 10 years. Oof. Right. So our plan is the most fair that I've seen, and it removes the 10-year wait that is currently required for clemency. And so we need all of your listeners to think about the mothers and grandmothers and grandfathers crying themselves to sleep at night and the children who have family members in those cages, in those prisons, that will die there. Wasted potential and talent. The answers that we're looking for out here are in those prisons.
Right, right.
We can't let another Sebastian sit 10, 15 more years in prison. We need him out here now. We need her out here now, whoever she is.
Yeah, no, I agree with you 100%. I mean, I think that, and I mean, I think also too, and I think this is very relevant as well, Sebastian, is when you look at a lot of young guys, you look at situations like Chicago, even D.C., where we've seen an uptick in murders. I mean, like, who are these young guys really going to listen to? You know what I mean? Like, some of them will listen to the advocates and the social workers or whatever. Some people, they are. But a lot of people, they need to hear it from someone who's been there and done that, whose only possible motivation could be to redirect. You know what I'm saying? Like, you're not getting a check to come talk to me, tell me, do whatever. But, like, you're like, hey, I did it. I was in there, and I'm trying to tell you.
And I'm glad you say that, because this, maybe a couple of days ago, I went down to the jail house. And I asked them, why are you doing what you're doing? And they told me, because I want my dad. And most of them won't need their moms, but this is what we're not paying attention to. You know, like you said, Chicago is out of control. Every city right now is out of control, not only with the police shootings, but with our kids killing one another, because guess what? It ain't no guiding. Right. It ain't no, I'm not the only one, but right now I'm the only one on this forefront, me and Doc. You know what I'm saying? Because if you was out here, hear me good, we would exit the foundation. Because if you was out here, you'd be at these events that we putting on. You'd be at our conference that we put on every year. You'll be calling our phone lines. You'll be calling this number to Washington, D.C. So you're right. You're not out there doing that. I don't want to hear it if you're on there and you waiting on a paycheck. Me and Doc don't get paid. We don't get paid for this. But we want heart. We want love, compassion. We want somebody who really care and willing to die. We going on a fast because I'm willing to take my own life. I'm willing to not eat, not drink, because that's how much I love my brothers and sisters and I want them home.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? But when is we going to start teaching our kids to stop doing what they're doing out there? It's time for you to let them go. Time's up. Let them go. Say it, Doc.
Time's up. Let them go. That's our campaign slogan. Time's up. We go.
Well, I think time is up. I mean, we've had like when did the new Jim Crow come out? 2011. So we've had like a 5-year conversation about mass incarceration. You even got people like Bob Goodlatte, you know, good old boy, Virginia Republican, saying, well, we better do something. You even had the Koch brothers in there for a little bit.
Yeah.
So it's like we've had the conversation. Everyone from top to bottom is saying it didn't work. You got Google. You got everybody. You got Netflix.
But look, we have to give a whole lot of credit to Michelle Alexander. That's a watershed moment with that publication. Mm-hmm. But prior to Michelle Alexander, since the you know, Nixon, and even before Nixon, we've been talking about these issues for decades.
And so at what point do you do something? I mean, I think from a lawmaker's perspective, that's how they got to look at it. And from Obama's perspective, from just like a legacy point, like if you got to leave one piece, like let this be the piece. It seems to me like of everything
of the
that it
that
was.
Completed everything in the world.
Could be huge.
You know what I'm saying?
Could be huge.
He don't know what you can do with this momentum right here. Mm-hmm. This is the time. You know, you came in office, focus on your one cliche, change.
Right.
Make the change, Barack.
Mm-hmm.
Make the change, Barack.
Yes, we can.
Fired up, ready
make
to go.
Make the change, Barack.
Fired up. Well, and so give me that number one more time from the White House, please.
202-456-1111.
And so just so folks know, you were saying doing a Facebook Live every evening.
Madeline McClenney Sadler, friend me, and that's how you find me on Facebook, Madeline McClenney Sadler.
We would like the superstars, the NBA players, NFL players, the rappers, the artists, come out.
No, I think that's extraordinary, and there is time.
And we're not partisan. Republican, white, black, Native American, immigrants, everybody has their role to play.
Time's up. Let them go.
Anyone who wants to do the right thing. Well, I think that's fantastic. ExodusFoundation.org. Madeline McClenney Sadler on Facebook. Follow them. Call the number. Protest. Demonstrate. Do whatever you got to do. Let's do everything possible in the next however many days, 10 days, 20 days, to just 14 days,
days,
I think.
14 days.
14 days to get this.
Thing?
Please.
So for people who are out there who are like, it's just not enough time. I wish you blah, 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 blah. I always like to say that Villanova won a championship last year. When Ryan Arciodiacono passed the ball to Chris Jean, because we have 4.7 seconds left. We don't need 15 days. We need 4.7 seconds. He can sign that decree, make that stuff happen. But if you don't speak out, that's not going
to
happen.
Shout out to the Wildcats. Well, we are going to take a break. We're going to be back with more here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking all about, well, a number of things involving the changing climate here and potentially what the Trump administration could do to make that happen more rapidly and more worse, and what people on the ground are doing to make sure that doesn't happen. And we are joined by Tim Donaghy, who's a senior research specialist at Greenpeace. Tim, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So I wanted to start here. You know, one of the things going into the new year that there's a lot of talk about is the big rollback of regulations that the Republicans are at least going to attempt to do. I think they're already trying to do some of them in Congress. You know, and so I wonder from a climate justice perspective, if some of the things we've seen towards the end of the year, the Arctic drilling ban and different pieces like that President Obama put in, if those are also potentially on the chopping block, if you will, in these early stages of the year here.
Yeah, no, that's a really important question. And I think, you know, there's definitely a lot of things that President Trump will be able to undo by executive order. The Arctic drilling ban that President Obama put in place might not be one of them. Obama used a little-known provision in one of the laws to permanently withdraw the Arctic and the Atlantic from consideration for oil drilling in the future. And according to the legal analysis, that the next president can't actually undo that. Now, I think that Trump will probably try, and he'll probably get sued, and it'll go to the courts to decide whether or not he has that authority or not. But I think in a lot of ways, you know, in this case, Obama may have found a way to actually permanently protect this part of this ecosystem and part of the world from oil drilling.
Mm. Well, and you know, one other thing, just, and I don't know, this is like maybe a broader question, a framing question, but I think a lot of people going into the Trump administration are perhaps who care about this issue feeling a certain sense of despair, which I could certainly understand given who they're putting in there. But I also wonder if, you know, perhaps the clouds aren't as dark as they seem. I mean, we have China coming out with the announcement this week, spending almost $400 billion on renewable energy. Jerry Brown been, you know, talking up a pretty big game about what California was going to do out there. I know where we are in Washington, D.C., there's some laws that may or may not pass, but look like they have a chance that are moving the ball forward here. Obviously, we have the Dakota Access Pipeline. So that to some degree, I mean, obviously, I think sort of being worried or not even worried, but being vigilant and being willing to push on the priorities is certainly warranted. But that perhaps, you know, we're not as far behind as it may seem, despite the negativity here from the Trump administration.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And I think what really gives me hope and, you know, keeps me away from despair is that I think there is a growing movement of people who are saying, you know what, the time has come to actually do something about climate change and about climate justice and about social justice. And I think that movement is what got us the victories we have today, and the movement is what will keep those victories secure going forward. Mm-hmm. And like you said, yeah, you know, Trump, you know, there's a lot of bad things he can do, but he's not, you know, he's not king of the world. And there's, you know, other, you know, cities and states and other countries around the world are already taking action. They're already putting in place good policies. I think, you know, at the Paris Climate Agreement last year, they said the age of fossil fuels is coming to an end. And I think that's true. No matter, you know, Trump can delay it for 4 years, but I think, you know, the writing is on the wall. You know, the transition to renewable energy is coming, and it's going to, you know, save people a lot of money, and it's going to save the environment. So I think, you know, we just need to keep pushing.
Well, you know, and it's an interesting question, and it relates to the point I made earlier about China's announcement, because this is what a lot of people have been saying, is that, you know, to some degree, and I think certainly looking at the wide range of countries that put the Paris Climate Agreement together and the sense of unanimity you got there, it could end up that the United States ends up getting left far behind. I mean, we're having such a huge conversation in this country about how do we create more jobs, but that, you know, the push here to maintain, you know, the jobs and sort of the old energy economy, if you will, as like the way to save working class people in America, could end up being an okie doke, as they say, where all these other countries become at the forefront of this technology and these new jobs and this whole new sort of era, 21st, 22nd century era, and, you know, we would be the ones left behind. Seems like that could be a pretty big ironic effect of this in the end.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think, you know, the future is clean energy jobs, and I think there's a real potential to create, you know, really hundreds of thousands of great jobs for people in that area, because we really have so much work to do. We need to be installing more wind power. We need to be installing more solar power. All of that needs, you know, skilled individuals to do that work. And I think, you know, Trump's doubling down on what you would maybe call 19th century technology is just, it's a real bad way to plan for a future economy that brings prosperity to working class people.
I think that's a great point, and it also speaks to another point that I know is very relevant to the work you guys do at Greenpeace, is the importance of having sort of a climate justice movement that really is focused strongly across borders, and that's sort of this is a global problem, it's a global issue, and if we're going to make progress on it, it's not going to be just like one country leading the pack or whatever, but it could be, you know, a handful of states in America or India or whatever, who at different times and different moments are putting things forward that help keep moving the ball forward. And that to some degree, like, that might be key to kind of keeping the momentum going, is not get too caught up in, well, is the U.S. going to do this? Is China going to do that? Is South Africa going to do this? But just keep pushing everywhere at all times and getting these, just getting the wins rolling in.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. And, you know, these markets are global, and so the movement of people that has to address them and make them better is also global. And, you know, Greenpeace, you know, we work in more than 30 countries around the world. And so we, one of the things we try to do is make those connections across borders and get people working together.
You know, one thing I'm curious about here, because this, and this is another sort of factor that a lot of people have been talking about. I mean, you know, you have the EPA, we have NOAA, the research institutes that are federal, people who are funded with federal research dollars. I mean, a lot of people who have put out a lot of great work to not only show that climate change is in fact real, not a Chinese hoax, but also propose solutions and things that we could potentially do. I mean, what's the, I mean, what is the ability of the Trump administration to hobble that? And is there some of that just sort of bureaucratic inertia? I know, like, for example, there's the National Climate Assessment that I think is coming out in 2018 that, you know, that can't, you know, some of, like, some of the people who are sort of in there and they're civil service employees, they can't fire them, still do have the ability to kind of push the needle here, even if the people at the top level are, you know, hoping they don't.
Yeah, no, I think that's really important. And I think, you know, you have to look back at what happened during the Bush administration to get a sense for the way that kind of political interference can really harm the federal scientific enterprise that we've built up at places like NOAA and places like the EPA. I think you saw what the Bush administration did, where they did the same thing. They handed over, you know, control of political appointments to, you know, folks connected with the oil industry. And, you know, those people started editing scientific documents, changing the findings of scientists, telling scientists that they're not allowed to talk to the media about their research, you know, basically just, you know, interfering in their work and the work that, you know, the American public relies on to get good information about what's happening in the world. I think we could definitely see that happening again, and I think it would really be a harm to the American public. And I think there's a couple really alarming things that Trump and the Republicans have done recently that we need to keep an eye on and be vigilant about, one of which is that the Republicans passed a rule saying that they're going to be able to reduce the salaries of any federal employee down to $1 via Congress, which is not something that's happened in a hundred years, essentially. So that's very concerning. I think you saw that the Trump administration was compiling lists of scientists and other employees who had worked on climate issues. And, you know, that definitely is worrying. I mean, we'll wait and see what happens with this. But it's not a, you know, it could be bringing us back to the days of the Bush administration where this sort of political interference in science was really rampant.
Yeah, no, I think that's certainly something that's worth being considered, and I think certainly speaks to the need for on-the-ground movements to be prepared to ramp up. And I'm curious, you know, what are you expecting in terms of especially pipeline resistance in 2017? I mean, there's so many other projects out there. I just have to assume the Trump administration is going to try to revive some of them. Seems like Justin Trudeau, Trump may try to cook something up there with the Keystone XL. I mean, are you expecting that this sort of the Dakota Access Pipeline piece, the Keystone XL piece, the seemingly sort of expanding push against pipelines will grow stronger in 2017?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think if you look at, for example, a recent report that came out last year from Oil Change International, they looked at how much carbon and how much, you know, fossil fuels are already in the pipeline, are already in development. And the amount of carbon represented by those projects is already enough to push us over. It's more than our carbon budget, essentially. It's already enough to push us over 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees of warming. So the movement is really focused on the idea that we can't afford to be building more fossil fuel infrastructure. So anytime there's a new drilling project like in the Arctic or a new pipeline that's going to be taking oil, you know, oil sands, tar sands from Canada down to refineries, that is inconsistent with limiting global warming to a safe level. So, you know, focusing on new fossil fuel infrastructure is going to be a really important part of this movement that, for climate justice moving forward in 2017. And, like, I think you mentioned the Keystone XL pipeline might come back, the Dakota Access Pipeline. Trump could undo what the protections Obama put in place there. There are, I know, pipeline fights that are brewing in Louisiana and in Florida and many other places around the United States. So I suspect that this will continue to be a really important place of resistance. And I think it's really interesting because it's one of those places that really it unites people, you know, across kind of ideological boundaries. You actually see, you know, Tea Party Republicans opposed to pipelines in their backyard, lining up with, you know, progressive, you know, liberals. And so it's really kind of an interesting place to be working.
Yeah, well, you know, and that's sort of an interesting reality, too, if and another thing that speaks to, you know, whether or not people should be disappointed. I saw some polls someone showed me earlier today about how, like, the vast majority of people, even many Republicans in these, like, deep red states, actually want single-payer health care to replace Obamacare. I mean, on an issue-by-issue basis, there's a lot of space here to start talking to people and building with people and creating those alliances that, like, when you label them R or D or whatever, then there's a whole other range of things that get involved. But when you just say, like, well, look, do you want them to be able to use eminent domain to, like, build this pipeline, take your land, and then poison your grandkids when it spills, like, that's a pretty easy sell.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, anybody who likes clean air and likes clean water and likes having a stable climate is an ally in this fight. And so I think that cuts across lots of lines.
No, I agree with you 100%, 100% there. You know, I wonder too, looking at this sort of the way the people are moving forward, what you expect from just sort of the interplay also of climate issues on a worldwide level, the growth of climate refugees and different pieces like that, and kind of changing the conversation in some degree where the frontline communities, which I think often maybe less ignored than perhaps in the past. I mean, I think we've come a long way from when the quote-unquote environmental movement was considered just middle-class white people. But I think even in some minds, it's still sort of like, well, you can afford to be for this. You're not someone who's working in a mine or whatever it may be, but that's sort of the heightened, I hate to say it's negative, but sort of the heightened focus I think that we may see on frontline communities, people having to move and to flee as things change permanently, not temporarily, as the storms and things grow crazier and worse and floods and whatever, that perhaps also will change the perception of how we look at the issue as not just sort of like a niche issue, but more of the global issue that it is.
Yeah, no, I think that's really important. And, you know, I think, you know, I lived in Central America for a number of years, and I think about the folks I knew down there, many of whom were farmers who, you know, their livelihood was getting enough food to come out of the ground to feed their family. And they were seeing climate change in their local environment, and it was making it harder for them to grow their crops. So when I think about climate change, I think about them, basically. And I think we need to really lift up the voices of the people who are on the front lines. And as you mentioned, you know, like, it's for people who do work, I think, you know, in the fossil fuel industry. You know, we need to be speaking with them and listening to them as well, and we need to be putting in place policies for like what we call a just transition, so that those workers can transfer into, you know, a better job that is in the clean energy sector or that is involved in creating a new economy, and that are not left behind, and those communities aren't left behind. So I think, you know, there's a lot of work to be done, and we need to like work on a number of different fronts and tie it all together.
Yeah, great point. And, you know, one, I don't want to bury the lead here, but you mentioned this, and I do want to bring it up, because I think sometimes we don't talk enough about this when we talk about this issue. You mentioned the dangers of temperatures rising beyond safe levels. Talk a little bit about what could potentially happen if we don't do this, because I think it seems like sometimes the debate becomes so much about whether climate change is, like, quote-unquote real or not. Sometimes we lose the actual things that we know are happening and that will get worse.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things, it's kind of a slow-moving disaster, so it's hard for the media to really focus on it. But, you know, when you think about temperature and how that's connected to rainfall patterns and how that's connected to food and how that's connected to, you know, human health in terms of, like, the air we breathe and the temperatures that are in our everyday environment, it connects to so many different things, that there are so many different types of impacts. And it's hard to kind of keep it all together in one place in your head. But, you know, the dangers and the risks are very real. You know, I grew up in the Central Valley in California, you know, where we've been having real problems with droughts. And that's really been impacting, you know, the local economy, but also, like, it impacts the health of the people who live there. You know, the fact that we have, you know, air pollution that piles up in my hometown over the summer causes people to die from heart attacks and strokes, causes kids to suffer from asthma. You know, these things are real impacts that are caused by climate change, but sometimes they aren't reported that way in the press. And so I think, you know, educating our leaders and also, you know, the citizens of the United States about what these impacts are, I think is going to be really important. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, you're definitely seeing folks who are starting to realize that actually what's going on is not normal. It's not the way it was when they were kids. It's not the way it was when their grandparents were living. And they worry about what it's going to be for their grandkids going forward. So I think that's the way we need to frame it, and just sort of really tie it to people's everyday lives and things that they care about.
Well, I think that's a very good point. One other thing that I think that is very relevant here too is, I mean, how much do you think it's important to kind of keep together sort of the anti-TPP coalition, if you will, on this issue and other issues? Because it sort of seems like to some degree there was a big win there in defeating TPP, and now the president and many of his advisors are critical of sort of big multilateral trade deals. But I think the sort of trick in that is they might try to get so many bilateral trade deals and sort of put in some of these just insane things, and maybe make a lot of these deals based off of, say, exports of natural gas or something like that, and a quid pro quo here and there with these individual countries. And what we could be, in an era where overall trade policy is being done in a way that, like, is more logical in the most general sense, but the things that they're putting in there are, like, just as bad.
Yeah, and I think, you need to sort of keep an eye on, some of the stuff that's going to fly under the radar that's not going to be decided by the president. It's going to be decided by the people he surrounds himself with. Mm. And so that's why I think it's important to look at who he's nominating and who those people are who are going to be making decisions over the next 4 years about some of these hugely important issues. And so we've been focusing, for example, on Rex Tillerson, who is the CEO of ExxonMobil, who is Trump's nominee to be the Secretary of State. And we're making a big push next week to get the Senate to reject Rex and to turn down that nomination, and because, we can't really afford to be turning over our foreign policy to basically an oil executive.
I think that's a very good point, and I think certainly we'll know some of the things that he would like to do and like to see. And I think that's an interesting point. I mean, I certainly joke a lot about how it's funny that the only person in there that seems to believe in climate change is the Exxon CEO. But, I mean, in terms of what he actually did, the impact that both Tillerson and, he's a lifelong employee, I believe, at Exxon, that Exxon has had in terms of the climate is really almost maybe like first in rank based on what we know about their scientific malfeasance.
Yeah, no, it's true that he has made some public statements in support of climate change science, but I think you should need to look what Exxon has done, not just what they've said. As you mentioned, there's been this scandal that back in the 70s and 80s, Exxon climate scientists actually knew about the dangers of carbon dioxide emissions. And instead of, doing the responsible thing and, working for policies to reduce the threat, Exxon instead started funding this echo chamber of climate deniers to basically push the idea that the science was uncertain, that we didn't know enough to act. And you still hear those basic same things being repeated by members of Congress today. So I think the harm that ExxonMobil has done to the debate about climate change in this country is tremendous. And, it makes no sense to put somebody like Rex Tillerson in charge of basically our climate negotiations in the international forum. So I think for that and a number of other reasons, he's a terrible choice for Secretary of State.
Yeah, no, I definitely hear you on that. And I mean, and some of the other folks they put in there have just been, completely absurd on so many different levels. It's hard to even know where to start. But certainly the other thing about Exxon to me that like is totally revealing to them that I think speaks to your point is their playbook in terms of how they're denying climate denial is the same thing as what Big Tobacco did in the 90s. I mean, it's all just create doubt, create doubt, create doubt, and then try to use that as your leverage to prevent any sort of major regulations, legislation, or whatever that comes forward. But maybe that's also a hopeful thing because we can look at Big Tobacco, despite spending $600 million a year, pretty ignominiously fell there in about 1 or 2 years, and everyone was against cigarettes. Either way, unfortunately, we're out of time on today's show here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. See you next time.
By any means necessary.